In 1964, financial backers were just like absolutely terrified to back a brand new Broadway musical.
Oh, they thought it was a guaranteed disaster.
Yeah, they looked at the pitch and decided it was, quote, too Jewish to ever attract a mainstream audience.
Which is wild in hindsight.
Right, because that specific show actually became the first musical in history to ever surpass 3,000 performances.
It really is kind of the ultimate theatrical paradox.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are so thrilled you're joining us.
We definitely are.
Our mission today is to explore an extensive overview of the musical Fiddler on the Roof.
And we're looking at how a story about a poor Jewish milkman in the 1905 Russian Empire became one of the most universally beloved pieces of theater ever.
Like in human history.
Hmm.
We've got a stack of sources here detailing everything from its really gritty literary origins to the incredibly fraught backstage brawls that almost tore the whole production apart.
And we are going to sift through all of it for you.
So to set the stage for you, we have to start with the baseline source material.
Right. Long before it was a Broadway spectacle, Fiddler on the Roof was based on a series of short stories.
These were written, what, between 1894 and 1914?
Exactly. By the Yiddish author Shalim Aleichem.
Okay.
And these stories chronicled the life of a character named Tevi the Dairyman. They were set in a fictional village called Anatevka.
Right, Anatevka. And that was located in what was known as the Pale of Settlement in Imperial Russia.
Yeah, which is a really important detail.
We should probably clarify what that actually means for you, because it wasn't just like a neighborhood.
No, not at all.
The Pale of Settlement was essentially a massive containment zone. It was a specific region in the western part of the Russian Empire where Jewish people were legally forced to live.
Right. They were completely restricted from moving freely throughout the rest of Russia.
Which is just incredibly oppressive.
It is. And that geographic containment is crucial to understanding the intense insular community dynamic of the stories.
Because they were essentially locked in together.
Right. Exactly. Sholem Aleichem's original text was heavily influenced by his own upbringing near Kyiv, and it was rooted in a deeply bleak reality.
Very bleak.
Like, the Russian authorities in the original text are relentlessly brutal.
Yeah, and the ending of Aleichem's original stories is profoundly tragic.
Completely devastating. By the conclusion of his tales, Tevi ends up totally alone.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, his wife, Gold, is dead. His daughters are entirely scattered to the winds.
Some to terrible fate,
right? Exactly. And when the edict comes down that the Jewish population is being expelled from their village, Tevi is packing up his meager belongings as a broken, solitary man.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand how Fiddler conquered the globe, we first have to look at how the creators altered the devastating original source material.
They had to make it palatable for a 1960s Broadway audience, you know.
Right. When you look at the original Sholem Aleichem stories compared to the musical adaptation written by Jerry Bock, Sheldon Harnick, and Joseph Stein, the differences are monumental.
Huge differences. The musical presents a much, much different vibe by the time the final curtain falls.
The Broadway adaptation definitely softens the blow.
Oh, for sure. Mm-hmm. For instance, the local Russian constable in the musical is portrayed as somewhat sympathetic.
Right. He actually warns Tevi about the coming pogroms.
Yeah, the organized violent massacres and riots against Jewish communities. The constable claims she is powerless to stop the violence, but gives Tevi a heads up.
Which is very different from the source material.
Totally. And at the end of the musical, while the community is still forced into exile, the family members are mostly alive.
And many of them are emigrating together to America to start a new life.
Right. But that specific softening drew some serious fire from literary circles.
I can imagine.
Yeah, the famous author Philip Roth, writing for The New Yorker, famously dismissed the musical as shtetl kitsch.
Ouch. Shtetl kitsch.
Yeah, he essentially argued that it took the genuine horrors and complex culture of the Eastern European Jewish towns, the shtetls, and turned them into cheap, overly sentimental souvenirs.
He felt it was too middlebrow.
Exactly, and that it glossed over the true historical devastation.
But, I mean, I kind of have to push back here. Like, isn't Roth missing the point of commercial musical theater?
How so?
I mean, it's like a modern studio taking a gritty, heartbreaking indie documentary and giving it a crowd-pleasing Hollywood ending. You can't sing a bleak 3-hour tragedy to a mainstream audience, leave the protagonist completely destroyed, and expect investors to fund a multi-million dollar run.
That's a very fair point.
Doesn't the medium demand some level of adaptation? Doesn't this sanitization ruin the historical integrity, or is it just necessary?
Well, what's fascinating here is how the show's creators navigated the psychology of their specific audience in 1964.
Right, the timing is everything.
You really have to look at the historical timeline. This musical premiered less than 2 decades after the end of World War II.
Oh, wow. Less than 20 years.
Yeah, it became one of the first popular mainstream depictions of the vanished Eastern European Jewish world following the Holocaust.
You really have to wonder what it felt like for a 1960s audience. I mean, many of whom likely had relatives who died in the Holocaust.
Absolutely.
To sit in a plush Broadway theater and watch a version of their own recent devastation.
That is the exact psychological tightrope the creators were walking. The Holocaust was an unutterably massive, gaping wound.
Right.
If the musical had presented the unvarnished, bleak devastation of Sholem Aleichem's original text, the audience would have likely completely shut down.
It would have been too much.
Exactly. Softening the ending acted as a psychological pressure valve. It let audiences, both Jewish and non-Jewish, release their grief and mourn that lost world safely.
Without the boiler exploding, basically.
Yes. It provided just enough hope to make the mourning process bearable.
That makes total sense. And the sanitization of the ending didn't erase the story's power because the creators brilliantly shifted the emotional weight.
It really did.
Instead of focusing solely on the external oppression of the Russian state, they focused the plot on a universal escalating internal conflict.
The clash between deep-rooted tradition and the unstoppable march of the modern world.
The structural brilliance of the musical lies in how it systematically dismantles Tevye's world.
Yeah, the writers use the marriages of his three older daughters as a mechanism to break down the culture piece by piece.
It is an absolute masterclass in escalating rebellion.
Moving from bending the rules to shattering them entirely.
We have to look at how this mechanism actually works, because the pacing is just incredible.
Let's start with the eldest daughter, Seidel.
Right. According to the strict traditions of their community, marriages are arranged by Yente, the village matchmaker.
And Yente arranges for Seidel to marry Lazar Wolf,
the local butcher.
Right. He's older than Tevye, and he is quite wealthy.
And for a poor milkman who literally has to pull his own milk cart because his horse is lame, a wealthy son-in-law is the ultimate security.
In the context of their society, the system is working flawlessly there. Tevye is securing his daughter's financial future and his own peace of mind.
But Seidel completely rejects this arrangement.
Completely. She wants to marry her childhood friend, Motel.
Who is a painfully poor, timid tailor.
Very poor. And Motel eventually works up the courage to ask Tevye for her hand, bypassing the matchmaker entirely.
They actually give each other a pledge.
Yeah, and Tevye is stunned by this breach of protocol, but he eventually agrees.
Which leads to him concocting this elaborate, hilarious, fake nightmare to trick his wife, Gold, into accepting the match.
It's a great scene, but that is the first fracture in the foundation.
Right. Seidel bends the matchmaking rule, but she still marries within the faith, within the village, and within Tevye's immediate orbit.
And then the second daughter, Hodel, pushes the boundary much further.
She falls in love with Perchik, right?
Yes, a student from Kyiv who harbors radical Marxist ideals.
And Perchik doesn't just bypass the local matchmaker. He actively mocks the community's foundational traditions.
He openly flouts strict religious and social rules by crossing the physical barrier that separates men and women to dance with Hodel at Seidel's wedding.
I mean, to a modern viewer, a man and a woman dancing together seems charming.
Right. It's nothing to us.
But in the context of a highly orthodox 1905 Russian village, that is a terrifying scandal. It threatens the entire social order.
It is a massive escalation. And when Perchik has to return to Kyiv to work for the revolution, the mechanism of rebellion shifts gears.
Because he and Hodel do not ask Tevye for his permission to marry.
No, they explicitly tell him they are only asking for his blessing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they are informing him of a decision already made. Tevye is appalled by this lack of authority, but again, he relents. He gives his blessing.
And shortly after, Hodel leaves her family entirely.
Right, abandoning the village to follow Perchik into exile in Siberia after he is arrested by the authorities.
So she breaks the social rules and physically leaves the community. The rebellion is accelerating.
The physical distance is definitely growing.
Which brings us to the third daughter, Chava. And Chava crosses the ultimate unforgivable line.
She's the quiet, bookish daughter.
Right, and she falls in love with Fyedka, a young Russian Christian man.
And when she asks Tevye to allow the marriage, Tevye finally hits a wall.
He reaches deep into his soul, but marriage outside the Jewish faith is a boundary he simply cannot cross.
He forbids her from ever speaking to Fyedka again.
And when Chava elopes anyway, Tevye refuses to speak to her. He turns his back on her and tells the rest of the family to consider her dead.
It's heartbreaking.
So what does this all mean? When you look at this progression, I really struggle to see Tevye as a hero here.
Really?
Yeah, he seems completely passive. I mean, he just lets his daughters walk all over his traditions one by one until he finally snaps and disowns the third one. How does that make him a compelling protagonist?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, Tevye is much more than just a passive observer of his own life.
How so?
The genius of the show lies in Tevye's internal monologues. He frequently freezes the action on stage to speak directly to God, weighing the pros and cons of every single crisis.
Right. He's very vocal about his inner turmoil.
Exactly. He acts as the avatar for every generation that has ever had to accept that the world is changing faster than they can comprehend.
Oh, I see.
He articulates the painful realization of modernity when he says, "Love, it's the new style."
So he's constantly trying to negotiate with the future.
Yes.
Bargaining with God to figure out how much he can concede without losing his identity.
Exactly. He learns the vital survival skill of bending so he doesn't break.
Right. He adapts to Seidel's choice of a poor man. He adapts to Hodel's choice to abandon the traditional permission structure.
He bends and bends and bends, accommodating the new world right up until the point where his core religious faith draws a hard line with Chava.
It's a deeply human portrayal of the absolute limits of adaptation.
We all have a breaking point where we decide that to compromise any further would mean destroying who we fundamentally are.
It really is an incredibly compelling character arc. But here is where the story takes a wild turn from the stage to the backstage.
Oh, the backstage drama is legendary.
While Tevye was battling a changing world in front of the audience, the creators of the show were engaged in an intense, historically fraught battle of their own behind the curtain.
The creation of the original 1964 production was an absolute pressure cooker.
The tension was largely driven by a massive ideological and personal friction between the show's director and choreographer, Jerome Robbins, and its star, the actor playing Tevye, Zero Mostel.
And the context of their friction is rooted in one of the darkest, most paranoid periods of American entertainment history.
The Hollywood blacklist.
Exactly. And the hearings held by the House Un-American Activities Committee, often referred to as HUAC, during the 1950s.
And we really need to look at their respective histories impartially here, right?
Yes, viewing them as a collision of two very different human responses to the crushing political pressures of the Cold War era.
Right. So Jerome Robbins, who was undeniably a genius of theatrical staging, had actually cooperated with HUAC.
Under immense pressure, he named names of alleged communist sympathizers in the entertainment industry.
And additionally, Robbins had hidden his Jewish heritage from the public for years, attempting to assimilate seamlessly into mainstream American culture.
Right. Now, on the exact opposite end of the spectrum, you have Zero Mostel.
Mostel was admired by many in the industry for his confrontational, highly theatrical, and defiant testimony before that very same committee.
He completely refused to cooperate.
A defiance that led directly to him being blacklisted in the 1950s.
His career was completely destroyed for years. He couldn't get work in film or television.
And because of this history, Mostel held Jerome Robbins in absolute contempt.
Oh, yeah. Their working styles in the rehearsal room couldn't have been more opposed either.
How bad was it?
Well, Robbins was a notoriously tough, demanding director. Reports from the time indicate he could be verbally abusive to the cast, drove the set and costume designers crazy with his demands, and operated as an incredibly harsh perfectionist.
He wanted every movement strictly choreographed.
Every single step. Mostel, conversely, was a massive, unpredictable, ad-libbing life force.
I could see how that would clash.
Oh, definitely. As the Broadway run went on, Mostel improvised more and more of his performance, changing lines and adding physical comedy.
Which reportedly drove the authors and Robbins completely up the wall.
Completely.
But the wild irony of this situation is just staggering.
It really is.
You have a musical that is fundamentally about the power of community, about shared tradition, and about surviving political oppression.
Yeah.
And the two main architects building this beautiful monument to Jewish survival are on opposite sides of a devastating political blacklist.
One man hid his heritage and cooperated with the government.
And the other wore his heritage on his sleeve and had his livelihood stripped away for defying the government. It's like two rival generals being forced to co-write a comprehensive book on world peace.
That's a great way to put it. Many theater historians actually argue that this exact volatile tension is what gave the original production its legendary spark.
You think so?
Yeah, the rehearsal room was a crucible. It forcefully fused Robin's harsh, exacting perfectionism and structural brilliance with Mostel's defiant, spontaneous, messy vitality.
So the friction generated an artistic heat that transcended their personal and political conflicts.
Exactly. Even the title of the show emerged from a place of artistic friction.
Right. They originally considered calling the musical simply Tevi.
But eventually landed on Fiddler on the Roof.
And the title wasn't named after one specific painting, right?
No, it was inspired by the general surreal aesthetic of several paintings by the renowned artist Marc Chagall.
Works like Green Violinist and the Fiddler.
Yes.
Yeah.
Chagall's style, featuring floating figures and dreamlike depictions of Jewish village life, heavily inspired the original, somewhat abstract set design by Boris Aronson.
It visually communicated that this was a memory play, not a strict historical documentary.
Though it's worth noting the historical footnote that Chagall himself reportedly disliked the musical.
Wait, really?
Yeah, he felt it didn't capture the true spirit of his work.
Which is just the perfect cherry on top of all the backstage drama.
Truly.
But despite the arguments, the political bad blood, Chagall's disapproval, and the fears from investors that the material was too Jewish, the show opens.
And it is an instant sensation.
It wins 9 Tony Awards. It runs for nearly a decade on Broadway.
But what happens next is what truly cements its legacy.
Because this hyper-specific, historically fraught production didn't just survive its rocky creation, it became a blank canvas for the entire world.
The global reach of Fiddler on the Roof is truly astounding. It wasn't just a hit in New York or London.
Where else did it go?
Well, in the first 3 decades after its premiere, there were 100 different productions mounted in West Germany alone.
Think about the weight of that. West Germany, staging a musical celebrating the vibrant Jewish life of Eastern Europe just a few decades after the Holocaust.
It was a profound cultural moment, and the reach continued to expand.
Yeah, within 5 years after the collapse of the Berlin Wall, 23 separate productions were staged in the former East Germany.
And even further afield, moving away from European history entirely, it became the longest-running musical ever seen in Tokyo.
That's incredible.
There is actually a famous, heavily cited historical anecdote about the Japanese productions.
Yeah.
A Japanese producer supposedly approached the American creators of the show and honestly asked them, "Do Americans actually understand this show? It's so uniquely Japanese."
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
Because its cultural footprint goes way beyond just regional theater productions and international tours.
It completely infiltrated global pop culture.
Yeah. In 1964, the exact same year the show opened on Broadway, the legendary jazz saxophonist Cannonball Adderley recorded an entire album consisting of jazz covers of the show's score.
And its musical DNA carried right into the 21st century.
Oh, for sure. In 2004, pop star Gwen Stefani and rapper Eve released the massive radio hit Rich Girl,
which was a direct adaptation of Tevi's famous song If I Were a Rich Man.
Stefani was actually inspired by a 1993 ragga version of the song by the British reggae duo Lucci Liu and Michi One.
Right. And Stefani's version maintained the core complaints about wealth, but modernized the sound completely.
It stayed on the Billboard Hot 100 for over 6 months and earned a Grammy nomination.
From a poor milkman in a Russian shtetl to a Gwen Stefani rap verse on MTV.
That is an unbelievable cultural trajectory. And the parodies.
Oh, there are so many.
It's been parodied in Mad Magazine. The cartoon Animaniacs did an entire episode called Pigeon on the Roof.
Robin Williams hilariously references it in the movie Mrs. Doubtfire.
And then, of course, there's the song Sunrise Sunset, which has essentially become a universal cross-cultural wedding anthem.
In fact, in 2011, the show's original lyricist, Sheldon Harnick, recognized how the world was changing.
Right. He wrote updated versions of the song with minor word changes to make it specifically suitable for same-sex weddings.
The adaptability of the show is matched only by its profound real-world resonance.
Definitely.
Perhaps the most poignant example of its enduring impact happened in 2015.
What happened then?
A real-life displaced persons camp was built southwest of Kyiv to house Jewish refugees fleeing the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
And the name the local rabbi gave to this safe haven, Anatevka.
From a work of historical fiction to a Broadway stage to a literal safe haven for modern refugees.
Wow.
This raises an important question. How does a story so deeply rooted in the hyper-specific tragedy of the 1905 Russian Jewish expulsion translate so perfectly to a Japanese audience?
Or to a 2000s pop radio hit? Or to modern refugees fleeing a 21st century conflict?
It translates because the underlying themes are not bound by geography or religion.
Displacement. The painful friction of generational shifts.
The desperate struggle to maintain one's identity in a world that is rapidly and aggressively changing.
These are universal human conditions.
Every single culture has its version of Tevi, trying to balance the old ways with the new reality.
So to wrap up this incredible journey for you today, we started in the harsh, bleak, geographically contained reality of Sholem Aleichem's Pale of Settlement Tales.
We moved through a Broadway adaptation that acted as a psychological pressure valve,
forging a deeply poignant masterpiece in the fires of the Red Scare and intense backstage rivalries.
And we ended up with a global phenomenon that gave us everything from Cannonball Adderley jazz covers to a shared vocabulary for modern displacement.
It really stands as a testament to the supreme power of storytelling.
By focusing with absolute precision on the specific, granular details of one family in one village, the creators somehow managed to write a story about everyone, everywhere.
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over today.
Okay.
In the prologue of the show, Tevi describes his life and the life of his community as being like a fiddler on the roof.
He says they are all just trying to scratch out a pleasant, simple tune without breaking their necks.
Right. And he explicitly tells the audience that the only thing keeping them from falling off that roof is tradition.
Tradition is their balancing pole.
But look at the trajectory we've just discussed. We've seen Fiddler adapted into reggae, pop, and global theater, crossing every conceivable border.
It leaves you wondering.
As our world becomes increasingly digital, fast-paced, and geographically borderless, will we even have distinct physical Anatevkas left to write stories about in the future?
Or will the traditions we are desperately trying to balance on the roof soon be entirely virtual?
As we navigate an era of relentless information and vanishing physical boundaries, finding that new balancing pole is a challenge we are all still trying to figure out.
We really are.
Until next time, keep exploring.